From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Friedman, foreign affairs correspondent for the New York Times. He just returned from Israel, Syria, and Jordan. He's covered the region for 27 years. We'll talk with him about Syria, its relationship to Hezbollah, Lebanon, and Iran, and why Syria may be essential to a ceasefire agreement. Also, we talk with Syrian dissident Ammar Abdelhamid, who now lives in the U.S. and is affiliated with the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. His mother is a movie star in Syria. He went to school with Bashar Assad, the president of Syria. Abdelhamid was told to leave his country last year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Tom Friedman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. He just returned from a trip to Israel, Jordan, and Syria. We asked him to talk with us about the war between Israel and Hezbollah and where Syria fits in. Yesterday, the Israeli Security Cabinet agreed to expand the ground war, and the Syrian government put its military on high alert. Tom Friedman has been writing about the Middle East since 1979, when he started covering Beirut for UPI. In 1982, he became the New York Times correspondent in Lebanon. 2 years later, he started covering Israel for the Times. His best-selling 1989 book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, won a National Book Award. Friedman's latest book, the bestseller The World is Flat, is about the global economy. Tom Friedman, welcome back to Fresh Air. One of the places you went on your Middle East trip was to Syria. Why did you want to go there?
Well, it struck me, Terry, that Syria is really at the center of so much of what's going on right now. First of all, Syria is the land bridge that connects Hezbollah in Lebanon with its primary backer, Iran. And Iran could not provide Hezbollah with the rockets it has, except by going through Syria. So that's the first reason I went there. Secondly, it's long been known that the Iranian embassy in Damascus has been the primary contact point for Hezbollah and the Iranians. And it seemed to me that if one were to step back and say, what would Henry Kissinger do right now? That is, what is the game-changing move that could really shake up this chessboard, and in a way that would be positive for American interests. If you think about where Syria is in this whole equation, the bridge between Iran and Hezbollah, the back room for Hamas in Gaza, and also the back room for the insurgents in Iraq, that the big game-changing move would be if you could somehow move Syria from an alliance headed by Iran back into its really traditional home in many ways, the Sunni Arab world with Jordan, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, countries much more pro the United States. That, if we could somehow do that, that's what would really change this whole equation. And really, as soon as the fighting broke out, I decided that's what I got to do. I got to get on a plane and go to Damascus and try to assess whether that kind of move is at all possible, because only that kind of move, I think, could really change the whole chessboard.
So who did you talk to try to assess that?
I actually interviewed the Syrian foreign minister and another cabinet minister and Syrian economist and lots of diplomats when I was there and local Syrian journalists. And I came away feeling that it's a real long shot. Syria and the United States are deeply alienated today. We have withdrawn our ambassador from Damascus, Margaret Scobie. She's been gone for months now. Our chargé d'affaires there is about to leave, a very able diplomat. He's about to be replaced by someone new. They're only allowed our diplomats there to meet with the chief of protocol at the Syrian foreign ministry, and his job is to ask you how you like your Turkish coffee. So we have really no dialogue with Syria. And the Syrians know that they're basically alone, but that they've got Iran at their back. Iran, which has billions of dollars in oil money today and lots of weapons, developing a nuclear capability. And so it would be very hard, but I also could hear in between the lines that it might not be impossible. It might not be impossible for several reasons, Terry. Number one, because, Syria is a Sunni Muslim country. Iran is a Shiite Muslim country led by a religious hierarchy. Syria is a very secular country. They're not natural allies. I don't think a lot of Syrians are comfortable in this relationship. And the best evidence of that, diplomats pointed out to me, is how many times the Iranians keep sending senior delegations to Damascus just to make sure everything's okay. So I think the Iranians are quite insecure about this relationship, which has no real historical foundation, no geographical foundation. It's a really artificial creation. I don't think it's impossible. The price for the Syrians would be very high. It would be a resumption of negotiations over the Golan Heights with Israel and probably some kind of tacit understanding about their quote-unquote legitimate security interests in Lebanon. But I think it's a dialogue at least worth having.
So if Syria separated from Iran and if Syria was invited to peace talks or ceasefire talks, What role do you think Syria could play?
Well, the most important role they could play would be to endorse an international force in South Lebanon, which would send a signal to countries wanting to contribute forces to such a peacekeeping operation, but a robust peacekeeping operation, not blue helmets, you know, with a bunch of Norwegians, Swedes, and Ghanaians, but, you know, a real NATO-like or Bosnia-like force. If the Syrians gave their green light to that, then I think countries would contribute. If they didn't, I think a lot of countries will not contribute. I don't think any countries will contribute.
During the years that Syria occupied Lebanon, and they pulled out their troops only last year, what did they get out of being there?
Oh, the Syrians milked Lebanon dry. Syrian officers and intelligence people basically, you know, pulled every important string in Lebanon. You couldn't really get any senior government position without their tacit approval. They were renowned for being involved in, you know, a myriad smuggling scams. And most of all, they basically erased the border between Syria and Lebanon in terms of Syrian workers. So you had the Lebanese economy basically absorbing up to, I think, as many as 1 million Syrian workers who couldn't find jobs in Syria. That was a big deal.
So they got money out of it?
They sucked Lebanon dry financially. They got money. They got jobs. And they got a broader sort of front with Israel to protect their flank. You know, Syria was basically in the Bekaa Valley, its soft underbelly, so Israel couldn't do a left hook into Damascus.
Now, you know, I was reading your book From Beirut to Jerusalem again over the weekend.
Bless your heart.
And you have a whole chapter devoted to Hama, which is a city in Syria in which there was an incredible massacre. Why don't you just explain what happened there?
Well, in 1982, Syria faced its own Islamist uprising. And at that time, Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current president, Bashar al-Assad, was in power. And for years, the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood was becoming stronger and stronger in Syria in opposition to the ruling Assad family, which comes from a sect of a sect. It's sort of a offshoot of Shiism, which is known as Alawite Islam. And the Alawis are about 10-11% of the population of Syria. Most of the rest are Sunni Muslims. And so you have this kind of minority ruling over this Sunni majority. And the Sunni majority at the religious end, there was this Islamic fundamentalist movement that basically was trying to topple the regime. The movement was headquartered, had its greatest strength in Hama. And in Hama, it basically made a bid to take over the town and use it as a foundation to foment a rebellion against the Assad government. And they had been involved in running clashes, the government and these Muslim brother groups, for months. But basically what happened in, I believe, February of 1982, Hafez al-Assad decided he was going to finish this problem once and for all. And he basically pummeled Hama, leveling whole neighborhoods. You've seen the pictures of Kana, the buildings that were brought down by Israel in South Lebanon. That was basically what whole neighborhoods of Hama looked like after days of pummeling by the Syrian army, artillery, and I believe probably air force as well. And one should know exactly what one is dealing with when you're dealing with Damascus. As I said in my column, this is a brutal, ruthless regime. I have no illusions about it. They are responsible, probably indirectly, for what happened to the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. Marines in Beirut. And yet we dealt with them afterwards. We dealt with them in Gulf War I. We dealt with them on the Madrid Peace Conference. You know, you gotta, in this neighborhood, you just have so many bad actors, and you really have to make a choice. Are you going to stand on principle and say, you know, we're not going to deal with you because you're really bad? That's cool. That's a policy. If we're going to go to war with Syria to make them pay for all the bad things their regime has done, I totally get that. But if you're not going to go to war, but you really need them, and you're just going to adopt this kind of aggressive verbal stance and some economic sanctions, then you kind of have the worst of all worlds, because basically you then have a hostile Syria but it's not afraid of you, and therefore you have no real leverage. And that seems to me to be the penumbra that we're in right now vis-a-vis Syria, and I don't see it serving anyone right now.
I just want to say something else about, this is President Hafez al-Assad, the current president's father. A month after the massacres in Hama, he said, "Nothing is more dangerous to Islam than distorting its meanings and concepts while you are posing as a Muslim. This is what the criminal brothers are doing, the Muslim Brotherhood. They are killing in the name of Islam. They are butchering children, women, and old people in the name of Islam." But would President Assad today, the son of that President Assad, consider criticizing Hezbollah for being dangerous to Islam because it was distorting its meanings and concepts and killing
people? No, this is
people?
All about staying in power. And if Hezbollah is ready to act as Syria's cat's paw in Lebanon, then, wow, we're all for Hezbollah and we don't really care. They'll just make sure that Hezbollah can never operate in Syria. The thing about Hafez Assad, the current president's father, is that he was the most dangerous kind of extremist. He was an extremist who knew when to stop. You see, what distinguished him from Saddam Hussein, who in the end proved to be a moron, was that he was an extremist who didn't know when to stop. He was always overplaying his hand. And, of course, the great thing about extremists is that they don't know when to stop, and they usually overplay their hand and undo themselves, as Saddam did. Hafez Assad was really dangerous. He was an extremist who knew when to stop. He knew when to level Hama and then when to rebuild it with lovely new government housing. He knew when to crush the Muslim Brothers and then build a new mosque around the corner. You know, he had a wonderful, wonderful, in inverted commas, sense of balance and survival. He was really the preeminent, you know, Middle East Machiavellian player. I don't think his son has anywhere near the sophistication of the father. But like I keep saying, it's worth testing, only because I don't know how the alternative of trying to ignore them is going to work.
My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times and author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. After the start of the war between Israel and Hezbollah, Friedman traveled to Israel, Syria, and Jordan. You think that Hezbollah miscalculated? You think Israel miscalculated too?
Too soon to tell. Too soon to tell. Certainly Israel miscalculated, if you think this is about a PR war, and Israel has, by tragically, hitting a building that kills 56 Lebanese civilians in one day, and this is a tragedy, has gotten a huge global black eye on it. But, you know, wars are fought for political ends, Terry, and we'll see what the political end is here. Nasrallah says, we've won already. We've stopped the Israeli army. And, we fought them to a standstill. We're the pride of the Arab world. And, you just hear that stuff and you want to weep. You want to weep because you want to say, don't you see? Israel's making microchips and you're making potato chips and you won? Israel is the Technion and you've got Hezbollah high and you won? Israel has more companies on the NASDAQ than any country in the world outside the United States other than Canada and you can't make a light bulb and you won? What a terrible thing to say. You know, I don't care. At the end of the day, what Hezbollah says about Israel, they can hate the Israelis and the Jews all they want. But you know what really disgusts me and makes me just enormously angry? It's not what they do to the Israelis. It's what they do to their own people. The future they have deprived their own children of. The fact that they hate Israel more than they love their own kids. That is such a travesty.
Do you feel agonized now over the civilian casualties in Lebanon from the Israeli air campaign.
Oh, of course. I mean, and this isn't some cheap, I feel agonized about all civilians. I lived in Beirut for 5 years. And I was so excited to go back to Beirut. I think it was 1999. I hadn't been back basically since 1982. And see the incredible amount of rebuilding that had happened. Some of it paid for out of the pocket, incidentally, of Rafiq Hariri. I have a lot of friends there. Lebanon's where I started my career. My wife and I started our marriage there. It breaks my heart to see this. And the tragedy of the Arab world today, which is so well documented in the Arab Human Development Reports, is that there are so many young people there who aspire to something different, okay? But the politics is really perverse. And when someone like Nasrallah, who is just another false messiah, just in the line of Nasser, another guy who will stand on the ruins and say, it isn't whether you win or lose, it's just whether you fight the Jews. Another guy who will stand on the ruins and say, look what we won. You just know what a long-term travesty this is. And let me tell you something from my perspective, Terry, that I would just add. You know, there's already all this commentary, Nasrallah won, Nasrallah won, Nasrallah won. Yeah, you know, in the Middle East, Terry, there's the morning after, and there's the morning after the morning after. I have no doubt if there's a ceasefire here, the morning after, Nasrallah will stand on the ruins and say, I won. We fought the Jews to a standstill. Yes, 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 yes. Applaud, 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 applaud. But the morning after, when people come home, they look at their homes that are flattened, their factories that are flattened, their futures that are flattened, there will be a reckoning. I reckon there will be a reckoning. The laws of gravity even apply to Hezbollah.
It seemed like Mahmoud Abbas, who is the head of the Palestinian Authority, was on the verge of getting some agreement on using a peace plan that was drawn up by Palestinian prisoners who are still very, very powerful politically, and using that as a template to start negotiations again. He was on the verge of moving forward with that when Hamas kidnapped an Israeli soldier. Do you think that timing was intentional?
It was intentional, Terry, but here's the real story. There's Hamas, and then there's Hamas's military wing. And the military wing takes direct orders from the Hamas commanders in Damascus, not from Haniya, the Hamas prime minister of the Palestinian Authority. And I have been told while I was in Israel that what was going on was that basically the Hamas political authority was looking to reach a power-sharing agreement with Mahmoud Abbas and the Fatah people. They were on the verge of that when the Hamas military wing, under orders from the leadership in Damascus, abducted this Israeli soldier to blow it all up. And so, that's part of the perverseness of this region.
So, in other words, Syria didn't want this agreement to go forward.
Syria didn't want this agreement to go forward, and the Hamas external leadership didn't want this agreement to go forward because it would have meant the Hamas leadership in Gaza then would have had greatly enhanced authority. So this was also an intra-Hamas struggle, because if Hamas inside Gaza and the West Bank were able to participate in the government in an effective way, open peace talks with Israel, the authority of Hamas outside would have been greatly diminished and become increasingly irrelevant.
And in that sense, they succeeded. I mean, they succeeded in stopping any forward movement and pushing things very backwards.
Bad guys, they win so often in that part of the world. It's been such a long time, Terry, since the good guys and good gals won.
Now, you've written that the world hates President Bush more than any U.S. president in your lifetime. What does that mean for America right now?
What it means is something really sad, which is that, you know, a lot of bad things happen in the world without us. But there aren't a lot of good things. I mean, big good things like a Kyoto, like a Gulf War I alliance against a mad dictator who invades Kuwait. There aren't a lot of big good things in the world that happen without us. And there are so many big good things now that we need to have happen, Terry, whether it is on climate change or on disease or on world trade talks or on trying to trying to somehow shore up the only elected democracy in the Arab world, albeit flawed, in Iraq. There's so many big, good things that we need to have happen, and we just are too radioactive. This administration has enormous moral clarity, and it has no moral authority. It has no moral authority because it walked away from Kyoto, an issue that so many people around the world feel is important. It has no moral authority because it perpetrated Abu Ghraib, but never really prosecuted anyone higher than the local grunts who did it. It has no moral authority because it came to Iraq in the name of democracy and has produced a complete disaster, you know, in many ways. And because of that, we can't do a lot of the big, good work that needs to be done right now. And that is really bad because these people are going to be here for 2.5 more years. And they are so radioactive, they glow in the dark.
Well, Tom Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Tom Friedman is a foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. From Bob and Mary Montgomery, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Syrian dissident Omar Abdulhamid. His mother is a famous Syrian actress. He went to school with President Bashar Assad, and he was asked to leave his country last year. He now lives in the U.S. and is affiliated with the Brookings Institution. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Omar Abdulhamid, is a Syrian dissident who left his country last year. He says growing up in Syria in the 70s and 80s, it wasn't fears of an Israeli attack that kept him up at night. If there was a boogeyman in his life, it was the dreaded Syrian security apparatus and certain government officials. Abdulhamid's family is famous in Syria. His mother is a movie star. His late father was a director. Abdulhamid studied in the U.S. between 1986 and 94. He's a poet and novelist and writes a blog called Amarji. He's also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Omar Abdelhamid, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me read something you recently wrote in talking about conflicts between Israel and Arab countries. You wrote, "I put the greater burden of blame on us because all of us, both people and ruling elites alike, are always so cavalier in our willingness to confront Israel and the international community and to supply them with all the necessary excuses and justifications for their acts of aggression against us." How does that apply to the current conflict?
Well, the adventures of Hezbollah, basically. Hezbollah, the reason why Hezbollah is acting against Israel and has been sort of attacking Israel for the last 6 years really has nothing to do with Lebanese national interests. It has something to do with Hezbollah's desire not to disarm and to hedge its bets vis-a-vis other communities in Lebanon by showing that it doesn't only represent a demographic power but also a military power. There is also its Islamic predilection. There is an inability, basically, to accept Israel's right to exist. And also there is Hezbollah's role as a proxy for Syria's, the Syrian regime interests and the Iranian mullah's interests, which is to dissuade public attention from their own internal problems and to create pressure on Israel for the return of the Golan Heights as far as Syria is concerned. And the reality is our main struggle is not simply to only get back the occupied land, but it's also to develop our countries and our economies. We are experiencing a lot of problems, and our main problems really are developmental issues. And we have been spending on the military and on armament for the last 30 to 50 years without really spending enough monies on education, on healthcare, on infrastructure.
Now, I know that you oppose the government of Bashar Assad, and you oppose the government of his father, Hafez al-Assad. But do you support the Bush administration's interest in regime change in Syria? And, you know, who knows what, if anything, the Bush administration would do to move toward that goal. But do you think that's a wise goal for the Bush administration to have?
Well, to be honest with you, this is exactly where I am, find myself always second-guessing myself. On the one hand, I don't want to see an Iraqi scenario in Syria. On the other hand, I cannot stomach the idea that an administration in the United States, whether it's the Bush administration or any upcoming administration, should sit down with the Bashar and have talks with him to normalize the relationship between the two countries at the cost of internal reforms. We have been through that path before. I mean, this has been the realpolitik policy that has been followed over and over again, and it always came down at the expense of internal freedoms. And this is not going to allow our societies to develop. The more we deal with the corrupt elites, the more we are going to have societies that are breaking up and going in a more radical direction. What I'm afraid of is that we are going to have a series of failed states in the region under the rule of these corrupt regimes because they are siphoning off all the fortunes, all the wealth in the country. They are not addressing in any serious manner the developmental needs of the country, and we are reaching in several of the countries in the Middle East, Syria included, a level where any more pressures, the entire state could collapse. So in a sense, I support regime change by internal means, simply because the rule of the Assads have brought us disasters and will continue to bring us disasters. But at the same time, I want America to back us only as far as putting pressures and isolating the Syrian regime. I don't want to see military action because this will also create a lot of havoc in the country and may not have may not even help our cause, because by that time we will be so entangled in American policies for the region and for the country, and that we will not be able to shake free from that. So it's a mixed approach, therefore. I just want the regime to be isolated, and I want us to then do the job of achieving regime change by hopefully orchestrating some kind of a velvet revolution.
When you were growing up in Syria, what were you taught about Israel in your school, by your parents, by your friends?
Basically, it's it shouldn't be surprising here that, we are taught to hate Israel both as a Zionist entity, as a Jewish entity, and we studied history from our own perspective, which blames Israel for almost everything basically wrong in our societies today, and the Zionist conspiracy and imperialism and so on. So I had a very unflattering views of Israel and the Israelis, and it's only when I came to the United States to study at the University of Wisconsin that I had a different version of history, and that I have in fact even had some contacts with Israelis. And increasingly in the early 90s, when we had the Madrid conference and then the whole peace process was started, the contacts began to be more friendly with Israeli students. Now we can talk actually about the possibilities of peace. And I think we had some hope, basically, that we can really end this in the 1990s, and we can start sort of a new chapter. And there is enough of blame to go around why this did not happen. You can blame the Israelis for dragging their feet. You can blame the Syrians, and I do a lot for also dragging their feet. I don't want to spend my time criticizing Israel and the United States and imperialism and Zionism and what have you, because there are enough critics out there of Israeli policies. In fact, all of our criticism is aimed at Israeli policies, but we don't have enough criticism of our own policies in the Arab-Israeli conflict or in our internal policies. So I spend most of my time doing that, which is why I sound sometimes too radical or unbalanced. But the reality is I don't have to repeat what other people are saying. We know where Israel is wrong. It's occupying our land. We understand how we got to this state of affairs. But what have we done right in order to get back our lands? The reality is our tactics have always been the wrong tactics.
What were you taught about the United States when you were growing up?
It's an imperialist nation. We are a socialist nation. So you can imagine the kind of rhetoric we've had. It's the usual Soviet-style rhetoric vis-a-vis American imperialism and so on. So, however, when it comes to America, the interesting thing is, of course, is American culture. So people cannot simply overlook American culture or American products. So, and whenever a brand has is really made in the USA or has an American feel to it, the people will simply prefer it over anything else. And American movies were always popular, and American TV series were always popular. For a while, the government tried to introduce Russian series no one wanted to watch. So everything you can imagine in the 70s and 80s that you've been watching in the States, you've been watching, from the Mod Squad to Hawaii 5-0 to Star Trek to whatever. We've seen them all.
It sometimes seems like it would be almost surreal to be watching shows like that while you're living in, virtually a dictatorship.
It is surreal. It is definitely surreal. But this is something that we have lived for. I mean, that's why many people say that we are so restricted and whatever. But the reality is we do have a cosmopolitan view that's much richer than people imagine. I mean, we've been exposed to American TV shows, French TV shows, Russian TV shows, even sometimes Chinese. And all of these have taken part in our upbringing. A lot of my friends tell me that, you're not true to who you are because you're so westernized and so on. And I look at them and tell them, what do you mean? I grew up listening to rock and roll as much as I grew up listening to Arab pop songs, and I grew up watching American movies. I'm true to who I am. I am a cosmopolitan person. I'm a cosmopolitan man. And this is my real heritage.
My guest is Syrian dissident Ammar Abdelhamid. He's now affiliated with the Brookings Institution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ammar Abdulhamid, and he's a Syrian dissident now living in the United States, where he's a non-resident fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Now, you grew up in a very well-known and special family. Your mother is a famous Syrian actress, and your father was a well-known film director. So did that give your family special privileges within Syrian society, or did it make your family more suspect by the government?
Actually, it gave us a special privilege, I have to admit. I have always been considered to be part of the very elite that I'm attacking right now. And I went to the same schools that our president, Bashar al-Assad, went to. We were not really colleagues or classmates. I've always hated his guts from way back then. And at the same time, one of the reasons why, when calling the president on a variety of interviews when I was in Syria up until recently, calling him Alfredo Corleone, the idiot mafioso and whatever, instead of actually getting shot or getting imprisoned, at least I simply got a call that it's about and for an interview. And in that interview, I was told by the president's brother-in-law and the head of the military security apparatus that probably it's better to leave the country at this stage. So I was given away.
Let me stop you a second. So when you made a comparison between the current president of Syria, Bashar Assad, who succeeded his father, Hafez al-Assad as president, you were interrogated for that? And why don't you tell us what the analogy was that you made between the current president of Syria, Bashar Assad, and Fredo Corleone from the Godfather movie. What did you say?
Well, basically, it's ever since he came to power, Bashar struck me as being weak and dumb. And I've always known him in school, and I've never really had a high opinion of him. So I was being interviewed because I also had this as a dissident who is very vocal, and as a person who is in charge of an organization, an NGO that works on relationship between minorities and majorities. I had a lot of interviews, and I was given a lot of interviews. And in a few of them, I compared the president to Fredo Corleone, the weaker, dumber brother, basically, in the Corleone family in the Godfather movie. So many people were always making comparison, well, perhaps Bashar would be Michael Corleone and he will legitimize the family business. And I told him, no, he's a Fredo Corleone. He's a weaker idiot brother who had no interest, in fact, in legitimizing the family business, and who was always manipulated by others to do their bidding. And to me, therefore, he was really not convincing as a leader. And having said that, yes, I got a call finally for an interrogation by the president's brother-in-law and the head of the military security apparatus, and one of the chief suspects also in the Hariri assassination. I was told off about this interview and about my activities and my statements. And after we had it out for a while, I was asked to actually leave the country. And had it not been for my background, and had my mom not been so famous and all, and had I not had some contacts also with such institutions as Brookings and outside, I would never have had the opportunity to leave. I would have been shot or put in prison or made to disappear, as some of my colleagues were. So indeed, I was lucky to come from a certain background, and I feel guilty about it a lot of times, but it's also the reality that has saved my life.
Is your mother still in Syria?
Yes, she is.
And do you worry that she might be punished for your outspokenness, even though you're living in the United States now?
She is too famous, I think, for her to be hassled in any manner.
Now, you are a dissident. You are a Syrian dissident. You oppose the government, and you also oppose Islamic radicalism. At the same time, earlier in your life, when you were in college, you had become a fundamentalist Muslim. And from what I've read, even considered going to Afghanistan in the late 80s to fight against the Soviets. How did you become a radical Muslim?
Well, this is one of those things that I've never really understood myself completely. It seems, however, the reasons were far more psychological than ideological. I was a very introverted child, and had my mom's fame and my parents' fame, and being under the spotlight all the time, sort of, you can say, was not a very comfortable thing for me. It brought the envy and jealousy of my peers in school, and I've really never really was comfortable with it. So I guess what happened is, at one point, religion empowered me. Instead of saying I'm shy, I can always say I'm religious. You know, I'm not introverted. I'm just simply not interested in going out and drinking and following girls. I wanted to, but I was simply too shy and inadequate. So I covered my teenage inadequacies and my youthful inadequacies with a layer of religiosity. And at the same time, religion really managed to bring me out of my shell, because part of the instruction is to actually go to mosques and to pray and to meet with people and to be active. So Islamic fundamentalism actually slowly made me break my shyness, made me become more social, stand up on my own two feet, and interact with people with much more confidence. But the greater the confidence I've gained because of these Islamic activities, the more also I questioned the nature of the ideology itself, because I was never really a person who was comfortable following other people's dictates. I've always had a free mind. This is the heritage that I've had from my family. They've always encouraged me to form my own conclusions and opinions. So as I was doing that and growing in confidence, I was also questioning the very basis of the ideology I have adopted. Eventually, this led me out.
Now, I've read also that the fatwa against Salman Rushdie also made you question the religion that you had become part of, or the radicalism of the religion you'd become part of.
Indeed. At one point, as I was going through this period of questioning the ideology, the Salman Rushdie affair also broke out. And even though I was willing to condemn the book without having read only excerpts of it that were sent to us by some Islamic groups in London, I still could not stomach the death sentence. I can see this as something that is definitely unacceptable. And at that time, I was interviewed by the Los Angeles Times because I was working as an imam in a mosque. And I condemned the book, but I also condemned the fatwa, which created a lot of problems for me with the Iranian community and the Shia community that also use the mosque to pray. After a while, I realized, frankly, that I cannot belong to that, and I cannot keep on doing what I'm doing, being an imam and preaching, whatever. It's something that I'm not interested in anyway, and that my views were really radically different from those of the congregation. So I left the mosque and read more about the country I'm staying in, about the United States, and finally decided to go back to college and study history. I was studying astronomy at one point, but I realized really I need to go back to Earth and root myself more in human values.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you've written a couple of novels. One of them...
Yes.
One of them is titled Menstruation. A very provocative title, particularly in an Islamic country. Another had an even more provocative title, The Whore with the Trillion Vulvas.
Yes.
Tell me something about these novels and why you wrote books with such, like, truly intentionally provocative titles.
The idea was to try to, for the first novel, Menstruation, was to deal with the concept of sexuality in our societies. Many people think that we are very conservative. They don't realize that we are only conservative on the surface, but underneath the surface, we can be very adventurous. The idea of writing something with this title, Menstruation, goes back to when I was a fundamentalist. In a mosque, we were, in fact, a group of young men, and we were studying Sharia. And part of the Sharia has to do with hygiene and feminine hygiene, and as such, the menstrual cycle, because women during the cycle are not considered to be pure. So there are certain things that they should not do, and certain things that they could do, and so on. So, and I was looking around, and we were all, young men, and the teacher was, of course, male, and I thought, why should we classify in the final analysis women according to liquid oozing out of their bodies? I mean, it's ridiculous. So eventually, the idea of writing something about that was always in my mind. And when I finally became, a heretic, I wrote about it in a heretical manner.
My guest is Syrian dissident Ammar Abdulhamid. He's now affiliated with the Brookings Institution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ammar Abdulhamid. He's a Syrian dissident who left his country last year and now lives in the U.S. He's a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. In an article in the New York Times Magazine in 2005 that was largely devoted to you, the writer said, Islamists have pushed liberals to the sidelines. As a result, the Arab world's democracy activists and intellectuals don't enjoy the same advantages their Central and Eastern European counterparts did back in the 80s. Do you agree with him that Arab dissidents now and liberals now in the Arab world don't have that kind of central role and visibility that the dissidents did in Eastern Europe in the Soviet era?
Yes, I agree. The liberals really are fighting an uphill battle in order to be heard by the streets and in order to get more credibility by the street. The reality is regimes have been oppressing the liberals and the secular forces in the country and across the region much more vehemently than the Islamists. You know, with the Islamists, they followed sort of diverse approach. They oppressed some, but they also tolerated and even encouraged others. With the dissidents, it was across the liberal dissidents, it was across the board attempt at silencing every independent voice out there. For this reason, we really don't have much of a grassroots support. Some of us do, and those who do are the older generation who had already been established before regimes had this chance to oppress them, and they had a resonance in people's mind and imagination that the regimes could not wipe out. But the new voices, and perhaps I'm one of the new voices, really were having a hard time being heard back home. Some of us complicated the matter by the fact that they use other languages like English and French to express themselves, and I use English mostly. So that also created sort of a language cutoff. But we feel much more comfortable, frankly, in these other languages because they're more dynamic. Arabic have become too stultified anyway. So we have become too alienated from our own culture and society also for our own good. We have somehow to go back and try to reestablish this connection with the heritage and see if we can indeed regain our relevance on the street.
There was a group of dissidents who were arrested just a couple of months ago in Syria for signing what's called the Beirut-Damascus Declaration of May 12th, and it called for the normalization of relations between Syria and Lebanon and for a properly demarcated border and the exchange of ambassadors, while also opposing United States and Israeli influence in the region. I'm wondering if any of those dissidents who signed this declaration and were arrested are friends of yours.
Oh, yes, all of them. All of them are friends of mine. And it's really a pity because I left just a few months before this whole thing happened. And had I been there, I probably would have been included. And in fact, these people are not simply friends, but many of them are older, so they are even mentors. And it's really a blow to the entire movement of dissidents and opposition to Syria that now our leaders are behind bars. But there are still enough of us outside also. And frankly, despite all this attempt at crackdown, there are a lot of people still writing and speaking from inside Syria to actually show that we simply are not willing to back down at this stage. We have staked a new ground, and we realize what's at stake here. It's really the future of the entire country, so we have no choice but to persevere in the course that we have chosen, despite the fact that we know that there are going to be a lot of sacrifices ahead of us. And so far, frankly, the regime, even though it cracked down on certain figures, it has not really been able to muster enough popular approval to crack down on all dissent. So that's also a sign that we have created some room to maneuver.
Well, one more question. What is it like for you sitting safely in your new home in the United States when you watch the fighting that's going on now in the Middle East?
It's surreal and depressing. Feelings of guilt are always there. Feeling of helplessness are always there. Feeling of deja vu is really dominates the scene also, as far as I'm concerned, because this is exactly the kind of mayhem I was saying will happen sooner or later, even though I didn't really necessarily expect Israel to be involved so strongly. I thought that we are going to end up killing each other. So Israel might just facilitate that and be a catalyst in this matter. We are worried constantly. You know, the kids and I, my wife, are definitely depressed, and we are developing also physical symptoms. We are seeing doctors left and right for a variety of symptoms that no one can explain except to say, oh, yes, when they hear about our background and whatever, oh, yes, definitely, it's depression, it's whatever. So the reality is, it's very difficult for us. I mean, being safe and at the same time being out, but yet we are still in, and we have to watch all this, and we can't be detached, really.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Omar Abdelhamid is a Syrian dissident who is now a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the war between Israel and Hezbollah with best-selling Israeli writer Edgar Carret and Palestinian writer Samer El-Youssef, who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. Carret and El-Youssef are friends and 2 years ago collaborated on the book Gaza Blues. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.